a perfect case for election reform.
You know, it's one of those situations where democracy stumbled, but justice prevailed.
Plus, revisiting family leave policies, or the lack of them. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51% The Women's Perspective. We hear a lot about political reform and election and campaign finance reform in particular. This year in New York, one race for the state Senate was a stunning illustration of just how badly the election process needs review. Former State Assemblyman George Amador, a Republican, was expected to trounce Democratic challenger Cecilia Kacik. And though the race was close, closer than anyone expected, it did look like he'd won. In fact, he declared victory and went to Albany to take his seat in the Senate. But a final count of previously challenged paper ballots in January gave the win to Kacik by a nose, and now she's been appointed to committees where her experience with this election will be remembered.
So your opponent actually declared himself the winner and tried to go to work?
Yes, he declared victory twice and actually showed up in Albany, claiming he was going to start acting as a senator. And I said, you know, we're not quite done yet. And we, you know, it's one of those situations where democracy stumbled, but justice prevailed. We got the votes opened. And we needed the courts to do that. The outcome was that I won by 18 votes in a race where over 134,000 people voted.
Is it over now?
It is now over, yes. And I am the one that's sitting in the Senate seat. And I'm the last Senate that was seated in the Senate chambers.
During your campaign, you talked about campaign finance reform and election reform. How has this experience informed your opinion now?
It's been an amazing experience, and actually I am the ranker on the elections committee for obvious reasons, those being related to my race and what we had to do to get the ballots open and campaign finance reform. So I'm sitting and ready to work, and I think these are very good issues for me to work on. I ran in a seat. This was the 46th Senate district, but it was the seat that was added in the redistricting process that took place 2 years ago, or last year rather. And this was the seat that was added it was assumed to help the Republicans keep their majority in the Senate, and it was pretty much designed for my opponent. His entire assembly district is within this Senate district, and there was this, you know, expectation that it was created for him and he was going to have the resources he needed to run and be very competitive. So most people just stayed away from it, and, you know, it's like, well, it's his seat. It's too hard to win. But I'm a mom who's sitting on my local school board, and we have serious problems with adequately funding public education in this state, especially in small city and rural schools. And frankly, I didn't want to sit there and just make bad decision of what do I cut first. And I didn't want to tell a kindergartner they had to wait a year. It was easier for me to run for the Senate. So I decided to run for the Senate instead of, you know, facing these draconian cuts that I didn't want to do. And I won.
Until this race, did you have ambitions to run for statewide office?
No, I did not. But I was a frustrated mom who saw things that were not getting addressed by the Senate. I'm not unfamiliar with the Senate. I worked there as a legislative analyst for 2 years when the Democrats were in the majority, so I know how it works. I think it was that experience that showed me that not only could I do what they're doing, I should do what they're doing, because I saw things that, you know, decisions not always being made in the best interest of the public, to put it mildly. And we need people who are going to care about their communities and make sure we're making decisions that are in the best interest of the people who are in our district. I saw a lot of involvement with money, you know, and when you have a campaign system in this state that relies on high-end donors, those are the ones that often have more influence in the political process and when decisions are getting made, you can bet that person that, you know, gave you $1 million or a lot of money will be knocking on your door. I'm just saying, we can do things better. We should do things better. So I was an advocate for campaign finance reform from day one. And as we the campaign went along and my candidacy became obviously viable, I think there was suddenly a lot of interest in my race. And two groups got involved. Protect Our Democracy was one, and Friends of Democracy was the other. And they paid for ads to get me on TV and the radio. And the ads basically said, here's a candidate, and here's what she stands for. And then people got more information about me, and they voted for me. So it was very exciting to see me, who started out with no name recognition and not a lot of money at all, actually win this race.
Did you at any point have to consider turning down large donations simply to comply with your own beliefs on this?
Well, they didn't donate to me. Actually, they did an independent expenditure campaign. So I had no idea. I never asked them to get involved. They did not work with us. I did not have any involvement in the ads or the mail that they sent out. And so there was no turning down of anything. They did their own thing and just happened to be in support of my candidacy. But they had publicly said they were getting involved in the race. So we knew who was involved. There's some organizations where you don't know who's behind the ads and who's behind the mailers, and maybe they could be negative mail against a candidate, and that's kind of seen as inappropriate. So definitely it's important to have transparency so you know who's paying for ads. To me, it leveled the playing field for me.
Do you think this is a pattern now that can be repeated with other candidates where perhaps they don't have the funding or the name recognition, but a group that supports their election will step in and say, we're going to support you?
Well, I think it shows people that if you're a viable, if you are a serious candidate, you're going to work hard, you're going to run a grassroots campaign and get lots of people involved in your campaign, you can do it. I mean, I started literally with nothing, no name recognition, in a seat that was designed for somebody else. Even the Democrats didn't know who I was. I think the school board members knew me, but that was about it. And I had to run around to these five different counties and figure out who's in the structure of the political process that I need to get to know and get them to help me collect petition signatures. I mean, it's one of those where women can, I think it's more about if women run, women will win in this state, because we come, I think, with a more common sense agenda, and you can do it. So I think it tells women, if you really want to do something, here's a scenario where I really wanted to do it, and I actually did it, even though the odds were against me. It also showed the political folks that, you know, New York State is changing. The demographics are changing. And, you know, if you have serious candidates in some, you know, maybe not solid one way or the other areas, you can run good candidates who want to do the work of the people and make common sense laws, and they can get elected. So I think it is saying you don't have to be the, you know, identified political person of the week to get elected. You can do it on your own, because I did.
But you do have some political savvy from working in politics.
I also worked for nonprofits who did affordable housing, and I was an advocate for them. So I worked around the legislature for many years.
And that's what I was wondering. Do you think that experience is necessary? Can you run for political office in this country without having that inside knowledge and experience?
Well, I think it helps if you know the process, because you're going to feel more comfortable with it. And I don't think I ever would have run for the Senate if I hadn't worked for the Senate. And it was my job to brief senators on bills and help them get prepared for floor debate. So it really opened my eyes to, like, oh, I could do this because I'm the one that's actually helping them do it. And that definitely, you know, helped my confidence to say, yeah, sure, you should be a senator. And I think if people are involved in local politics, that's a good way to start learning how to get involved in, you know, I'm on my local school board. I think that's good training for the Senate, because everything you do is public, and, you know, you have to be thoughtful and listen to the public and give them opportunities to understand what's happening with their schools. So I think being involved in local politics is very helpful.
And talk to me, too, about what you see as the potential for change with women in political leadership positions. You said they had a more practical agenda. There is a perception that when women are part of a leadership discussion, the discussion changes. The way the discussion is held changes. Do you see that as a possibility?
I do, and I've seen it in action. I think women, and their studies have been done on this, women tend to get involved in politics when their kids are of an age they can take care of themselves, and they see things that need to get done. And women tend to be more collaborators, and they want to get something done, and that's often why they're going into politics. It's not to put another rung on their resume. And I've seen, we have a new leader in the Senate Democratic Conference, and that's Andrew Stewart Cousins. And the minute we appointed a woman leader, it very much changed the dialogue, and people had been talking about the Democratic Conference in New York as dysfunctional. When she became leader, that changed, because the discussion was, wow, now we have a woman leader, and we all like her, and she's a collaborator, and she's, you know, the discussion about her and the conference changed. So I think it definitely, I've seen it make a difference.
And I wonder, are you looking around and identifying women and saying, these women should be running, there should be something done to groom these women, to prepare them for leadership roles?
I am, actually, and I am encouraging them, and I would love to talk to organizations about this particular race, and, you know, kind of what were some of the hurdles, because it was not easy, and there definitely were hurdles, and I've learned a lot, and it would be, it's a fascinating story, and I'd love to tell it to other women if they're interested in politics.
Democrat Cecilia Kacik is the newly elected senator representing New York's 46th Senate District. Coming up, the U.S. trails in family-friendly work policies, and a country where a charge of witchcraft can still be used to take a woman's land. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1234. March is Women's History Month, but there's still no pay equity. Only 16% of Fortune 500 company directors are women, and just 8% of the Fortune top earners are women. In addition, the United States is one of the only countries in the world that doesn't offer paid parental leave. Veteran public radio reporter Ann Garrels looks at what this means for American families.
When it comes to paid parental leave, the United States is in an exclusive club, along with Papua New Guinea and Swaziland. These are the only three countries in the world that don't have national laws requiring paid maternity leave.
In the United States, working families have far fewer protections than they would have in almost any other country.
That's Janet Walsh. She's the author of a new report on parental leave in the U.S. from Human Rights Watch.
We interviewed 64 parents across the country at all different income levels and different professions, and without a doubt, all of these parents said that they would have benefited tremendously from even a bit of support, even for a few weeks.
In most of the U.S., paid leave is left largely to the whim of employers. Many workers have no paid family or sick leave whatsoever, and about half the workforce isn't even eligible for job-protected unpaid leave. Walsh says this leads to health problems, financial problems, and career disasters.
Your options are to go back to work far sooner than is healthy for you, healthy for your baby, healthy to establish breastfeeding, and just to get back to work within weeks in some cases, or to quit. And we see that in many countries, and even in the United States, there's been studies about employers being able to retain good workers if they have decent policies for parental leave. And so you lose a lot of very qualified workers by not giving them just the basic ability to sustain their families in a short leave in a critical time and get back to work when it's healthy.
Those least likely to have any paid leave are low-income workers, those who need it most. A young woman, we'll call her Samantha, is typical of dozens interviewed. She worked for a nonprofit in Brooklyn. After her son was born, she took a month of accrued vacation and sick time. An infected C-section incision forced her to take another month of unexpected, unpaid leave. After 8 weeks, Samantha had to return to work or lose her job.
8 weeks is what my job was telling me was the last week before they could hold my job any longer. So it was kind of like I had to go back that week. It wasn't something that I really wanted to do at the current time. Was I ready? I would say no. I didn't feel like I was ready to go back to work. I wanted to at least have gotten my son his second set of shots before I went back to work as well, because I knew he was going to be around other children. And those are the things that came up in my mind. But it was kind of like, you know, I have no choice. I have to, you know, get back out there and start work right away.
When Samantha got back to work, she couldn't afford to take more unpaid sick days for doctor's visits. The only place she could pump breast milk was in a highly trafficked, unhygienic public restroom with no electrical outlet. She had to stop breastfeeding. And when she couldn't work late shifts after daycare closed, she was let go. Her savings were exhausted, as well as her once stellar credit.
I had 2 student loans I had to put on deferment. My credit cards went into default, so I ended up filing for bankruptcy. So it really, you know, made a big dent in my life, because it's like now I have to wait another 3 to 5 years to build my credit again and to get back on my feet to save. It really put us back.
Samantha's trying to start her own business now so she can have a more flexible schedule.
It's really embarrassing and dreadful that a country as rich as the U.S. treats its families so poorly.
Janet Gornick is professor of political science at the City University of New York Graduate Center. She's an expert on family leave. She says many European countries have excellent policies in place.
In most of these countries, if you give birth or adopt, first of all, you'll have 3 to 5 months in any of the continental countries, similarly in the Nordic countries, of fully paid 100% leave with the right to hold your job and return to it. If you're in a partnership, in some cases a same-sex partnership, certainly in a heterosexual partnership, your use of maternity leave can be supplemented by your own use of some parental leave after the maternity leave. Your male partner can also take parental leave in many cases up to 6 months frequently. So between you and your partner, you can keep a child at home, certainly throughout the first year of life, as you wish, with a large part of your pay.
Gornick says there's no evidence such programs hurt the overall economy.
Virtually every country in the world has figured out that paid maternity leave is feasible. And nearly every rich country has figured out that paid parental leave is feasible. And these programs are maintained during periods of reassessment and retrenchment and restructuring. And there are 6 countries that I've studied quite a bit that have very good programs of paid leave and child care. That's Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, France, and Belgium. And across virtually every outcome, the results are better in those countries.
Janet Walsh of Human Rights Watch points to successful, if modest, programs in California and New Jersey, the only 2 states with public paid family leave insurance programs.
In New Jersey, for example, workers pay a maximum of $18 a year into a paid family leave insurance fund. This insurance fund then makes it possible for workers to tap into paid family leave benefits for a short time, for about 6 weeks after childbirth or adoption, for example, and get about $560 a month. So this is not some enormous contribution by employees. In fact, there's no government or employer contribution to this fund, but that little contribution makes it possible for workers who really need help at a critical time to get some basic support. So this has not been devastating to other economies. In fact, it's been helpful.
International treaties have long recognized the need to provide better support for working families. Human Rights Watch says it's time for the U.S. to sign on. and begin a vigorous public debate on how to implement these policies across the country. I'm Ann Garrels.
That report comes to us from Human Rights Watch. Find out more at hrw.org. A 20-year-old woman accused of sorcery in Papua New Guinea was reportedly tortured and killed on February 6, according to spokespeople for the UN Human Rights Office. Kipari Laniata was burnt alive in front of a crowd by relatives of a 6-year-old boy whom she was accused of using sorcery to kill. Cecile Pouyes tells UN Radio's Mamadou Alpha Diallo in Geneva that cases of women being brutalized and killed due to accusations of sorcery are a growing trend in Papua New Guinea to deprive them of land and property.
We'll see more and more cases of brutality and killings of people accused of sorcery in Papua New Guinea. Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women visited Papua New Guinea in March last year, and she already raised the issue, saying she had met a number of victims and that the sorcery accusations were commonly used to deprive women of land and property, and that there were growing cases of torture, rape, mutilations, and murder related to sorcery.
And do you know if these people accused of this crime was brought to justice?
Only a few of them. In many instances, these cases of sorcery-related killings and attacks take place on the rural side and remain undercover, so we have limited information. We were told that in November 2012, 5 people were allegedly killed after being held and tortured for 20 days after being accused of murdering someone through sorcery. So these cases exist, but they are mainly underreported.
And Avipile is calling on the authorities to demonstrate their political will. But can you tell us more on this constitutional act?
Sure. In 1971, a Sorcery Act was adopted. It's an act which contains the crime of sorcery and defines what sorcery is. Last year, the Constitutional Law Reform Commission met and held consultation to review this act and came to the conclusion that the Sorcery Act should be repealed. So in the light of this latest crime, which is really a heinous one, we really encourage the authorities to hasten the process and to strengthen the legal response to these killings.
How the UN Human Rights Office is helping and dealing on this issue?
Well, we've contacted repeatedly the authorities, offering our technical assistance and raising the issue. Only last year, when the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women was in the country, it was in March last year, she raised as well the issue with the authorities after meeting many people who were explaining the situation on the ground and how many women are accused of sorcery and people using sorcery to deprive them of their rights, but also their land, their property. And this issue affecting disproportionately widows or women who have no family to protect them.
Are you optimistic? And what generally is the response of the government on this issue?
Well, the government has really reacting to this latest crime, saying this is really unbelievable that this is happening in the 21st century and that prompt action will be taken. And we welcome this prompt reaction. And now we're calling for this really prompt investigation into this crime. And we really hope that the perpetrators of these attacks and killings will be brought to justice.
That interview with Cecile Pouyer of the UN Human Rights Office in Geneva comes to us courtesy of United Nations Radio. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% Archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.